of the hollows and creeks. If and you get lost for weeks. Listen to the tale of a man who got lost 100 feet under the winter frost. Now Floyd was a reasoning man. He knew what he wanted and he had a plan. He was just as smart as he was brave. He was gonna find him the perfect cave. Even Floyd knew something wasn't right. He was suffering nightmares at night. But he didn't worry about what he dreamed. Things was going good, or so it seemed. When looking for his fortune under the ground, sure enough, his fortune is what he found.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am pleased to welcome Ted Sperling to the show. Hi, Ted.
Hello, Donald.
Ted is here because the Lincoln Center Broadway cast recording of Floyd Collins is now out on CD. It's also available on digital and streaming, of course, from Center Stage Records, which is very exciting. I don't know if there's word about a vinyl version or not. I always have to ask that now because vinyl has become a thing again. Right. So I don't know if there's word on vinyl yet. Floyd Collins, of course, has music and lyrics by Adam Gettle, a book and additional lyrics by Tina Landau, who also directed this Broadway production. For those of you who don't know, Floyd Collins had its world premiere back in Philadelphia back in 1994, and then was produced by Playwrights Horizons off-Broadway in 1996. And then it's been kind of part of the regional theater repertoire, and I think also internationally for all these many years since then. And it's finally made its debut on Broadway this past season, where it was nominated for multiple Tony Awards. And Ted Sperling is a director, a music director, and orchestrator. He won a Tony Award for The Light in the Piazza, one of the great, great musicals of the past several years. And he's also sometimes an actor, which I had kind of forgotten about. You were in the Broadway musical Titanic, and most recently on TV in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which was, I had totally forgotten that you were in that, but you were in that also. You served as music director on the original off-Broadway production of Floyd Collins, and also that in that capacity on the Broadway production most recently. So wanted to talk to you about, first, your long association with Adam Gettle. And do you remember how you first got involved with Floyd Collins all those many years ago?
I do. Yeah, thanks for all the kind words. I met Adam when he was finishing high school, actually. And I was just out of college. And we met at the recording session for the original cast album of Sunday in the Park with George in 1984. His mom, Mary Rogers, knew that Adam had a fascination with electronic keyboards and electronic music. And I was the synth player for Sunday, and I was playing a big monster instrument that was sort of state of the art. So when she came to the first day of recording, she spotted that and asked me during a break whether it'd be okay if her son Adam sat with me the next day. So that's what we arranged. So we had a fun day in the recording studio that Tuesday. And I have some vague memory of maybe giving him a tour of Yale when he was interested in going there. But we had Tina as a friend in common because Tina was at school right in between us, just 2 years behind me and 2 years ahead of Adam. So I befriended Adam, you know, various ways. We had mutual friends. And when I heard that Tina and Adam were working on a show together, I let it be known that I was interested in working with them. I had already done a number of Broadway shows, starting with Sunday in the Park, but I was working as mostly an associate music director or a pianist at that point. And I was eager to be the music director. And I thought the best route to that would be to work with my colleagues, my peers. And I knew that anything that Tina and Adam would come up with would be wonderful and interesting and challenging. So I was thrilled when they asked me. And I joined the project after they had done an initial workshop in Philadelphia. And I stayed with it after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for the listeners, for their benefit, describe exactly what the role of a music director is, because I don't think everybody actually knows the role. Because it's a role that's not always conducting either, because a conductor can be different than a music director.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you for asking for that. It's a very good question. Well, the director of a show leads a team of three in rehearsal. Uh-huh. So there's the director, who's really the ultimate authority. And then usually there's a choreographer and the music director, and the three people are a triumvirate of creatives guiding the rehearsal process. So the music director is representing the composer and lyricist in rehearsal, making sure that their work is well interpreted, but at the same time also collaborating with the director and the choreographer to make sure that the music and the staging go hand in hand. So that often will involve creating introductions, interludes, endings, scene change music, based on the composer's work that then supports the staging idea of the choreographer and the director. So say the director needs more time for someone to enter the stage. They don't usually go to the composer for that. They'll turn to the music director who's right there with them in rehearsal and say, I just need 4 more seconds here. Uh-huh. What can you do now? And it's the music director's idea, you know, music director's responsibility usually in that situation to come up with a quick solution, run it by the composer, sometimes adjust it with a little bit more time to think about it, and then it can become part of the score.
Uh-huh.
Music director also is the liaison between many different people who have a role in making the music happen. So that can be a choral arranger, or sometimes the music director is the choral arranger. So if the composer just writes a melody, but then it needs to be adapted and harmonized and textured for a group of people to sing, that can become the music director's job. For example, the finale of Sunday in the Park was one of my first experiences witnessing that. Sondheim wrote a beautiful song, but it was not arranged for chorus. And it was Paul Gimignani who experimented with our cast and came up with the iconic vocal arrangement we all know of the finale of the first act.
Uh-huh.
There's also the orchestrator, which is a very big part of any musical. Another person whose work may be a little bit obscure to a general audience, but a composer usually writes a piano part with vocal lines. And then the orchestrator's job is to reinterpret that for a group of musicians. And it can be anywhere from, you know, 2 to 30. An orchestrator often is the person who chooses what instruments will be used, given the budget. And the music director is supposed to be the one who explains to the orchestrator what the goals are of a particular song or a dance number, and make sure that the orchestrator is on the same page as the director, choreographer, and music director in delivering that version of the song. Then there's also the music copyists. We want the music to be beautifully legible and publishable. So there are specialists in that area who transform handwriting into beautiful, publishable versions, who keep track of changes, who do a lot of cleanup. There are people who specialize in arranging music for the dance moments, called dance arrangers. Often mm-hmm. the music director works hand in hand with that person. And there's often a music assistant who keeps the score up to date, because in rehearsal for a show, things are changing daily. We had wonderful assistants on Flick Collins who helped with everything, including punctuation and making sure everybody had the same version of the punctuation for the script and for the score and for the CD booklet, etc. So that's just, and then on a bigger scale, you are helping shape the interpretation of a show. As music director, you are teaching the music to the cast, you're coaching them on their performances, making sure that they're singing in line with what the director wants from their acting. Sometimes you are helping them with their singing on a technical level, or mm-hmm. finding them a good vocal coach or a voice teacher. Sometimes going to their lessons and then reinforcing those lessons in rehearsal. And then more often than not, you're also going to be conducting the show, but that's not a given. There are music directors, including myself, who sometimes prefer to be out in the house and hire a separate director to lead the orchestra and the cast from the pit. There can be an advantage to that in that sound design has become such a huge part of any modern musical, much more so than in the Golden Age. And what you're hearing from the podium may be vastly different from what the audience is hearing. And there's no way to tell until you go out and sit in an audience seat. So, for example, during Floyd Collins, I had to do a number of performances and previews before I felt comfortable handing over the baton to my associate. And then I did sit out and listen, and I was quite surprised sometimes by how it sounded. I had strong reactions, and then I would give notes. But once you give notes, you actually have to go back and listen again and see how did those notes resolve. You know, is it better? Is it worse? Did you cause more problems than you solved? Is it solved throughout the house, or does it only sound good in certain sections? Right. What's it like in the balcony? So if you're watching every preview and you have a separate conductor, you can really be on top of that. I found on Floyd, I had to really trust that the other people who were listening, like the orchestrator and the sound designer, were keeping track. And it was, a challenge on Floyd, and particularly because the sound was quite complicated.
Well, of course, yeah.
So I guess that's, do you have any other questions about what a music director does?
No, I think that's, that's really thorough. And because I mean, I knew myself because I've actually had a couple of music directors on the show in the past, and the listeners are always really surprised at how extensive the work is for a music director. It's sort of like one of these unknown jobs and roles, and how important it is, and how much they actually touch. Because I think a lot of people just assume, oh, it's just the guy who stands in front of the cast during rehearsals and like conducts them in rehearsals, and they don't realize how important and how vital you are to making sure that the vision of the director and the composer and everything's going along the way it's supposed to go, and how much input you have to the vision of the of what's going on. So talk about the fact that, you know, here with Floyd Collins, you're revisiting, and I would assume in some ways rediscovering this piece, you know, 30 years on, and adjusting it from Playwrights Horizons, which is a relatively small off-Broadway venue, to the Vivian Beaumont Theater, which is a much larger Broadway space, one of the best Broadway spaces for anybody who hasn't been there. It's a gorgeous theater, and it's definitely not your typical Broadway house at all. So talk about just some of the challenges and thinking about from your perspective, from Tina's perspective, of making the revisit work to bring the show from 30 years on in that off-Broadway space to a new Broadway space.
Well, it was, I think, somewhat atypical. I've done quite a few revivals on Broadway, including several at Lincoln Center, South Pacific, The King and I, My Fair Lady, for example. Those were not directed by the original director.
Right.
You know, and I think typically, and quite a few of the shows that I've worked on over my career have been revived, including Sunday in the Park twice. And usually you're expecting to see an old show through the eyes of a new director, a new team, and often with a very, different approach than the original. With Floyd, I know that Tina and Adam entered into the process thinking that there were some things they knew they wanted to change, but they were also being careful not to ruin something that they loved. And I think for them, it was different than for me, because they wrote it. You know, Tina also wrote it. It's easy to think of her as the director of the show, but it's important to remember that she also wrote the show, that she found the original idea, that the whole structure of it, you know, it was hers as much as Adam. And they were quite young writers when we did this in the mid-90s.
Right.
And they've had 30 years of experience since then. So it's very tempting to go back and bring it up to date with your current level of experience or your current taste. And one thing that they did know right away that they wanted to change is they thought they were working too hard in the 90s version to capture the authentic dialect of this place and time, rural Kentucky in the 20s. And they thought they went a little overboard with sort of regionalism, So that's one of the things we cleaned up right away. And there was actually, it wasn't so easy because there was a lot of dropping G's, for example, in a word that ends ing. And the original, we're going to put all the G's back. But then we actually started to work on it and we realized in many places it was better with still without the G. And then we were also working with a dialect coach who's not, you know, that's quite common on shows these days to have someone who's really expert at making sure you sound authentic. And there was a bit of a tug of war of like, how authentic are we going with this accent and how much are we making it just people talking?
Right.
Then in terms of music, which was more my area, of course, I said, are we changing any of the music? The biggest changes we contemplated and actually did something about were two moments that involved something that was either cut or not recorded. So the first is a song it called It Moves. And it was part of the show from the beginning. It's one of the first demo recordings, actually, that we unearthed. And it's a song that Floyd sings when he finally discovers this cavern of his dreams near the beginning of the show. He's been squeezing through these very tight passageways, pretty confident that there's some fantastic cavern to be found if he can only reach it. And he finally reaches it. But it's very dark. It's a big space, and all he has is his own little lantern to light it with. And it's a kerosene lamp, and it doesn't cast such a powerful light. So he has to sort of feel his way around the cavern and imagine what it looks like a bit through looking at little pieces at a time. So he sings this song about the cavern itself and its history and how he's the first man maybe ever to set foot in it. And he claims it as his own. He scrawls his name in the sand on the floor. It's a beautiful song, and it really establishes a lot of the harmonic language that Adam then uses later in the score. But when we first produced the show, the feeling was that it was taking too long to get on with the story. And so that song got cut. We did record it on the original cast album, so people don't realize it was cut. Most people only know this show from the recording.
Yeah.
A handful of people got to see it in our short run at Playwrights Horizons. So everybody assumes that's part of the score and part of the show, but it hasn't been for 30 years. But Adam was very eager to see if we could put it back and not necessarily near the beginning of the show because the same problem would occur if we put it back there. So the whole rehearsal process was a hunt for where can we put this song? And we tried several different places. We even tried putting it back in the beginning. And it found its place midway through the second act during a stretch of the show where Floyd sort of disappeared for a while. And it was good to check back in with him.
Curving back and around so slow. So big it moves. When you try to take it all, if you try to see it all, when you think it's getting closer, it's getting further away, grinding down deeper under. Looks wet, every wall looks wet, melting with a snow made of cream, shining everywhere with tiny diamonds. Shine the lantern and get all the colors of the world coming back, all the colors of the world. No more than a bone. guess I just remember when there was a river going through centuries ago, back when there was dinosaurs and when there was Adam and Eve. Things happen and folks forget, but the rain soaks it up and collects it here. No telling what's on these walls, layering on snow like a stone history book with a couple of sentences about me.
And then there's another song that Floyd sang in the first act that was never recorded because it was really a fragment of a song, and it gets interrupted in the show. But Adam had this impulse that it could be more of a complete song, and he spent the rehearsal process trying different versions, and he did expand it, and we did record it on this new album. So that will be a new treat for people to enjoy. It's called And She Had Blue Eyes.
Right.
It's a very beautiful song, and it's still short, but it's now pretty much a complete song.
One of the things I find really intriguing, which you sort of referred to a little bit, is the fact that all of you who were part of the original team from Playwrights Horizons, who were working on this Broadway production, you're all basically 30 years older and 30 years more experienced. So from your perspective, what had changed for you in terms of your perceptions of the show and your feelings about the show, just overall? I mean, because you now have a whole world of new experiences. You've now worked at Lincoln Center on multiple shows. You've won a Tony Award since then. You've worked with Adam on Light in the Piazza. You've had all these worlds, you're a little bit more removed from it since you were not one of the original writers like Adam and Tina. So you can kind of maybe step back a little bit from the ownership of the property. But perception-wise, what's changed for you in terms of how you look at Floyd Collins?
Good question again. Weirdly, I'm not sure that much changed. I've always loved the show. It's always been an experience that I look back on with great fondness for the process of it as well, not just the end product, but I loved working on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big challenge. It felt really fresh. And I was surprised how fresh it still feels now as a piece of writing, especially its music. I don't feel that the score is aged in a bad way. I feel like it's only, we can appreciate it even more maybe now. One of the great pleasures of that first production was the song Is That Remarkable, which is sung by the three reporters at the top of Act Two. This was a song, well, let me just give you a little background. When Adam and Tina first started writing Floyd, and I was not in on this very, very first stage, it had much more of an operatic quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
The songs were not organized so much as songs. They felt a little bit more like a libretto set to music. And the music was more experimental and less in the tradition of the Broadway musical, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So this reporter song was a completely different song when I first started working on the show. And it was more in this avant-garde, somewhat operatic land, although of all the songs, the reporter song has always been the most popular sounding because it's the outsiders. It's the people from the big city.
Right.
But I remember it was like operator, operator, bing, bing. Like it was a lot of weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
Put me through to Bowling Green. Like it was much more angular and much less of a vaudeville song.
Mm-hmm.
And we loved it. It was a real challenge. It was very much in the language of the show at the time. But as the show developed, and Adam was writing more and more songs, and he was taking over more and more of the lyric writing, somehow that song came up for discussion, and Adam decided to take another stab at it. And he brought a version into rehearsal. We were fairly far along in our Playwrights Horizons rehearsals. So this was really for Playwrights, not even for the Philadelphia production. And it was this guitar-based swing song that felt like out of vaudeville a little bit, but it had no vocal arrangement. And we had three reporters who had to sing it, so there had to be some way for the three of them to sing it together. And so on the spot, in rehearsal, I wrote a vocal arrangement on our three singers, who were amazing people, including Brian D'Arcy James, who's gone on to do a lot more of Adam stuff. So that arrangement was one of the great, like, memories for me of ever being in rehearsal. And it was a thing that we then took another look at when we revived it just recently. Like, should we change any of that? And we experimented with a little bit of changes, but pretty much left it alone ultimately. And that was part of this process for us. We would try things, go, and then it's like, you know, probably better just to leave it alone.
Skeets rules Cave City. Pluck is infectious. Hell, this Miller guy's making us locals look bad. Every time you turn around, he's down under with Floyd, and we're up here, you know, sitting on our butts.
I don't think we look so bad.
Well, I sure wouldn't mind having my picture in the paper.
Yeah, mine too.
Get me New York City, hello Chicago. Could you put me through to Bowling Green? You ready for the lowdown, the real straight poop? Here comes the motherlode scoop. Get me New Montana, hello Savannah. Could you put me through to Abilene? You ready for the info, cause she's a pip. I'm mighty glad I made the trip. Cave City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 4. Caveman Underground.
You got it?
Yeah. Caveman Underground, imprisoned by rock.
Somewhere in the cold hills of Kentucky, comma, a caver named Floyd Collins lies pinned in a sandy cave by a boulder on his foot, period.
The Kentuckian is trapped for no one knows how long under a two-ton slab of granite, period.
The brave man lies in a coffin of stone, comma, trapped under nearly
7 tons of rock.
Is that remarkable?
That's remarkable.
Is that remarkable enough?
The most amazing thing I ever saw.
Is it incredible?
Whoa!
I wonder what tomorrow will bring.
Mr. Carmichael, I need to speak to you. I have a new idea. I want to go down again, and this time I want to try a jack and a crowbar. I think I can pry the rock off his foot.
You're not serious, Miller.
I am. This plan can work, sir. We have to try something, and soon. The one thing we can't have happen is for Floyd to lose hope.
Floyd's starting to lose hope!
Lose hope!
Lose hope!
What? Excuse me, I didn't say Floyd's starting to lose hope exactly.
I want the Walla Walla Bugle, the Paducah Tribune. Is this the Mexicali Telegram? You ready for the lowdown, the real straight poop?
Here comes the motherlode scoop.
I want the Alamogordo Banner, the Boise Gazette. Give me the bumblebee in Birmingham.
You're ready for the goods, cause she's ready to pop. This is going over the top.
Cave City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 5.
Cave victim losing hope.
According to Skeets Miller,
huh?
Comma, Collins is quickly slipping into a state of deep despair. Period.
Asking for milk.
Trap man was heard to cry out, comma, quote, get me out of here, comma, even if you have to tear my foot off, exclamation, close quote.
Floyd is reported to be in a state of delirium, conversing with cave crickets and even begging them
to hurry, 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 pull me out.
Remarkable.
Wait.
Is that remarkable enough?
If you report what you see,
is it incredible?
Whoa.
I wonder what tomorrow will bring.
There's a fella just arrived from the People's Bank, and he's saying he wants to help us with our money trouble.
Oh, God bless him, Janie. Where is he?
God bless him.
God bless him.
The Collins family is deeply religious.
Give me the Lackawanna pulpit, the Pierre Picayune. Is this the Tallahassee Democrat?
Sharpen that money, cause here's the dope.
Chock full of tragedy and hope.
I'd like the Ponca City Sun, the Saginaw Globe.
Put me through to the Escanaba.
Grab that feather and double dip.
This bird is ready to rip.
Collins family waits and prays.
K City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 6.
Nellie, Jane, old man Collins sitting on log.
The picture of the old weathered farmer and his bent backwards wife is a touching one, period.
The virginal sister is a colorful example of the folkways and eccentricities of the hillbilly life, period.
Remarkably enough, comma, although they live such simple lives, comma, the Collins family manages to own a car and even wear shoes.
I'm freezing.
Huh?
He's free.
What the?
Lloyd Collins is free.
Hogwash.
Hell no.
Voted
he's
at.
Free.
Hooray.
But I was just with him and he's not free.
Skeet Smeller, celebrity hack. I wonder what tomorrow will bring.
Come on, you know you're yellow. Now listen, fella, this ain't no literary magazine.
I only want the goodies, the mother loves scoop. I only want a scoop. I only want a scoop. I only want a scoop.
I would say, though, that my greater maturity now maybe allowed me to even have more of a bird's eye view, because I knew that the music was good already, you know, and the arrangements were already good. Mm-hmm. So what else, you know, maybe why wasn't the show like a giant hit? Is there anything that we could do to make it more appealing or more, you know, to a wider audience? And is everything about the storytelling really clear? Is it emotionally hitting its moments well? So I tried to just be a third person's, you know, just a sounding board for the two creators. We did discuss a lot of possible changes. And again, we didn't make that many ultimately. There were also questions about how to adapt this show to this much different space. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. The original Playwrights Horizons, which is different from the current Playwrights Horizons, mm-hmm. it was around only 2/3 of the size of the stage that it currently exists and had an entrance only from stage left. You could not enter from stage right unless you went off stage right and just sort of squeezed yourself against the wall and then re-entered where you came from. Mm-hmm.
Right.
There was no crossover, no way to make a dramatic entrance from anywhere else. And it had its own claustrophobia built in, because it was basically a shoebox of a theater and Floyd's position was right up against the wall. And so you could really feel the constricted circumstances in which he was trying to survive. At Lincoln Center, that was much harder to achieve because it's such a big open space.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not just a bigger theater. It's a theater in 3/4 seating. So it has a round
audience
configuration and a thrust stage. So that where the stage is thrust out into the laps of the audience. And then this, and Tina's concept has always been, I think, that if this were at Lincoln Center, she wanted to use the whole space so that you would sense the landscape in which this happened and also the size of the cavern that he finds.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's enormous.
Right.
And I've always hoped that when we did Floyd again, there would be a vertical element, that you would feel that there was underground and above ground, and that when he discovers the cavern, he's really going deep underground, 150 feet. And so Tina really took that as her own challenge too. And so the staging was a lot more dynamic than the original in that way.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit also about the expectations for this Broadway production, because, you know, as you mentioned briefly, the 1996 run at Playwrights Horizons was short. It was only 25 performances. But the show has become sort of this mystical, legendary production back in 96, I think mostly because of the legacy of the cast recording, because so many people are familiar with that, have fallen in love with the show because of that original cast recording, even though not that many people could have seen it only with 25 performances. So the expectations for this Broadway revival were really high, because you had all these people who either had never seen it or they had seen regional productions of it, but they all kind of had these certain perceptions as to what it was going to be and what it was going to look like. And you're never going to make everybody happy, because they've all got this mental picture of what they think the perfect Broadway production of Floyd Collins is going to look like. So was that a factor for anybody? I mean, because you've got, to me, I would think that there's this pressure of Floyd Collins is finally coming to Broadway, you know, after 30 years. And, you know, people have got these great, it's this show that everybody just adores because of the recording. And there's these expectations out there. But I guess you kind of have to turn a blind eye to all that and just work in the bubble you're in to create the best thing that you can create based on what you guys see, right?
Absolutely. I think you've put your finger on it really expertly. once you go into rehearsal, or once you start going into production, you do have to let go of the pressure of what people might think. You have to do what you want. You have to try to live up to your highest standards. And you enter a process knowing things might change. And in fact, we actually found ourselves making some unexpectedly big changes in the staging concept because we did a workshop in the fall. And luckily, we were working in the building where the theater was going to, you know, where we were going to be working upstairs. And we were asked to take a look at Floyd's main position once he gets trapped. And when we took a look in the theater and in real life, not just in a model, but sitting in the audience seats with things taped out, and we changed all those things. And I think Tina was imagining a very different position for Floyd originally and realized that there was a good reason we did it the way we did originally, and she had to go back to that. I personally think it was a really gorgeous production. And that I thought it took very good advantage of that space. I was a little, shall we say, curious about how this giant wall of LED screens would work. We had the back wall of the stage was a giant TV, essentially. And I was wondering how that technology would fit with this 1929 period and the rural aspect of the show. But ultimately, the brilliant designer who designed the imagery for that, and Tina, I think worked miracles with that. And I ended up loving it. We did expand things a little bit to fill the stage. We had a few more cast members and we had four more musicians. And I'm very grateful that the theater found the budget for that. I do think it made a difference. I think it still sounds very similar to the original. And I'd be curious if your listeners hear, you know, a big difference in the orchestrations between the two albums, because everything was reconceived, but at the same time, I think we preserved the essence of the score. A very sensitive job.
I think it sounds, I listened to both recordings to prepare for the, for this show. And I think they sound very similar. I actually have a preference for the new recording in some ways, just because I think it sounds a little, richer. And I think you also have some extraordinary performers in this cast. I mean, you really do. Not to diminish the original cast. The extraordinary people of the last time, but you have some really wonderful singers in this new, in this Broadway cast. So it's really nice. And it's actually kind of nice to hear different people singing these songs and interpreting these songs. So that's part of it also. It's kind of a fresh take on the material.
And we have to acknowledge we're building on the work of the original cast. You know, this cast has the advantage of being able to listen to somebody else sing it. And then take it in their own direction. The original cast had only us, you know, Adam and me.
And
Terry, I should mention Teresa McCarthy, Terry as we call her, was a part of the show from the very beginning. She was in that very first workshop that I didn't even do. And I think Marty Moran may have been as well. So they're, and I think their contributions to the show were enormous. And live on. And I know that like Lizzie McAlpine was so thrilled to meet Terry when she came to see the show. And I think we were all very eager for the original cast to come and see our new version. And Adam threw a party for everybody. It was really very beautiful to see the original cast and the new cast meeting and comparing notes.
Well, there's something really special about the show. There always has been something really special about the show. Like I said, it's sort of got this interesting legacy through musical theater people. Why do you think, I'm really curious, why do you think that the show speaks to so many people? Especially, like I said, the fact that there are so many fans of this show who were only familiar with it because of the original off-Broadway recording.
I don't know that I have a definitive answer to that, but I do think this struggle of someone who's caught can apply to so many people in a more metaphorical sense. I think so many of us feel caught or stuck or wondering why and how to keep going and what, how to get past a seemingly impossible obstacle. I remember when the show was first written, we were still in the thick of the AIDS crisis. You know, we think of the AIDS crisis as being an 80s problem, but in the, you know, first of all, this show was still being, was being written in the early 90s. And I remember feeling that so many shows, whether they meant to or not, were beautiful expressions of the struggles that everybody was going through. Into the Woods, for example, I remember when I first saw that, I really felt that the giant in some ways was AIDS. Mm-hmm. And for Floyd, so many of us witnessed so many friends who were young, vibrant men who were intrepid and forging new paths in whatever field they were pursuing, but particularly in the theater. And then they were being struck down in the prime of health and confined to beds and having to witness their own deterioration. And then all their families and friends struggling with how to help them and being, feeling helpless, which is so much the story of Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it had great resonance then, whether people made that direct connection or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know that people love the show for this reason, but the whole idea of the media taking something personal and making it an explosive news story,
right,
and a sensational news story has only gained in relevance.
Right. Exactly. I was going to say, because I mean, it is a true story. Roy Collins was a real person, yeah. and his being trapped in the cave was one of the first examples of an event like that turning into a media circus, and yeah. The whole nation was like captivated. Yeah, it was it made headlines all over the country, yeah. With people like following the story as to whether he would be rescued or what was going to happen. Do you have any favorite moments in the show? Favorite musical moments, and have they changed? In the 30 years?
Good question. Well, I think related to your last question and flowing into this one, I think maybe one of the strongest elements of the show is the bond between the three siblings,
mm-hmm.
or amongst the three siblings, but particularly Floyd and Homer as a duo, and then Floyd and Nellie. And one of the really heartbreaking things is that Nellie never gets to see him in real life and vice versa once he gets trapped.
Right.
That they only communicate through their sort of telepathic connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then so the dream sequence where he dreams that she's actually reached him and frees him is so powerful. And it's always been one of my favorite moments. And Through the Mountain, similarly, I think Through the Mountain is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great affection for that song, and it's sung so magnificently by both Terry in the original and Lizzie McAlpine in this new version.
Right.
And it's such beautiful writing of Adams. I love the guitar accompaniment for it. I love what Bruce did with the orchestration, and they kept that very similar in both versions.
I gotta go into the cave. He needs me. It's getting time.
Miss Nellie, you're not allowed to be here. You know they closed this area off.
But the wind!
You can't go under. Well, it's too dangerous, and you couldn't possibly...
But why can all you go like fire, like air? Tain't fair that all you go. You men going under, always scooting around and running things. Always going around and running things. Tick, tick. Tick-tock, 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 I'm aching to go. Please, I'm aching to set him free. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I'ma come to you, Floyd. No matter what, I'ma walk you through the mountain on the bearskin rug, through the great halls you dream of and tell of so often. I'ma keep you just as warm as a good night hug, as we fall along the diamonds to the outside. Take me on a tour of the Emerald. the spires of sapphires and waterfalls of crystal. We'll lay down to sleep with the gypsum flowers as we follow along the diamonds to the outside. Ooh, gonna get you out of there to a land of babies dancing with a banjo in the air. And the sky is all lit up with lemons and roses. Everything from your head to your toes is warm. Listen to me now. I'ma walk you through the mountain on a bearskin rug, through the great halls you dream of until love is orphaned. I'ma take you by the hand and with a gentle tug. We'll be gone, we'll be long gone as we follow along the diamonds to the outside. As we follow along the diamonds to the outside.
This idea that she sort of has confidence everything's going to be okay, even in the face of every piece of evidence to the contrary. I think, and then, you know, I'm very proud of the reporter's song, and I love both recordings of that too. I just love the contrast with the rest of the score. I think the six men who sing it on the two albums are brilliant. It's such a hard task. They rehearsed so hard, and this most recent version was very highly choreographed to an extent the original was not. And so not only did they have to sing this very hard arrangement, but they had to dance continuously through it and do this very fast dialogue and time everything out perfectly. So that's another favorite moment for mine. And then, of course, How Glory Goes, which is a song, if anybody only knows one song from the show, it might be that one. It's such a great song to begin with, such a wonderful idea for a song about what is heaven really like? What are the particulars? What do I have to, what am I entering? And then the fact that he sounds out heaven the way he sounds out the cavern with his voice and using the echoes to try to get a sense of the whole. I just think that's such a beautiful ending for our piece. Actually, when we did the show in Philadelphia, it didn't end with How Glory Goes. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
There was a reprise of The Ballad of Flood Collins. That's where the reprise happened, which was after How Glory Goes. And it was Homer on the vaudeville stage, lit by little stage lamps, you know, on the, on the edge of the stage.
Like footlights, yeah.
Footlights in front of a red velvet curtain with a straw boater and a guitar, I think. And he was telling the story of his brother's fate on vaudeville, and that's how we ended the show originally.
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not. That's interesting. Very interesting.
And Jason Danieli was in that Philadelphia production where we did it that way as well. And he was very, very young at the time.
Wow. Well, I like, I highly recommend the new album. It's terrific. If you need a physical CD, like I said, it's out on Center Stage Records now in physical CD format. Yeah,
with beautiful pictures and all the lyrics and a beautiful, note from Tina about the revival and how she and Adam approached it. So I do recommend getting the physical copy if you can.
Yes. And you have a busy thing, some busy stuff coming up. If we can segue, with the press and Lizzie McAlpine, you have got Sweet Smell of Success coming up in November as part of Master Voices. And you guys will be at Jazz at Lincoln Center on November 21st and 22nd with Raul Esparza. and Lizzie McAlpine doing a concert version. So talk briefly about that for people who don't know about that, because I understand you're working with Craig Cornelia and John Guare to do some revisions to the show. Yeah. I saw the original production with John Lithgow and Brian D'Arcy James and a very young Kelly O'Hara.
Yeah.
How's that going?
I'm very excited about this. I'm working very hard on it. Master Voices is a group that I've been leading for close to a dozen years now. We do a big theatrical event in the Broadway vein at least once a year. We did Sondheim's The Frogs recently. We've done all three Gershwin operettas, this political operettas. We did Lady in the Dark. We did Anyone Can Whistle. And so Sweet Smell of Success is our new project. And yes, I'm working with the writers, John Guare and Craig Cornelia. Unfortunately, Marvin Hamlisch is no longer with us to help. And I loved the show when I saw it back in 2002, and I was surprised that it didn't get more acclaim and run longer. But part of my job is to try to figure out why and try to make it even more accessible and exciting this time. So John and Craig both had the same idea of things that they might want to revisit. And they jived with my memory of the show. So we're working on some fairly subtle revisions. It's not going to be a wholesale rewrite. But I'm excited to try to bring a new eye and ear to that show. And with these two leads, and we're finishing the casting now, so we'll have some more names to announce really soon. I think we'll have a great cast. Top-notch orchestra and chorus, choreography, costumes, hint of a set design. but it's only for three performances, so act quickly. The tickets go on sale, I think, tomorrow to our most valuable players category, and then to the general public a week later. And it's not such a big haul. Every seat is good, but they're going to go fast. So
keep an eye out for that. I will make sure to include a link for Master Voices on the White Radio Show webpage so people can find out information about Sweet Smell of Success and get tickets for that, because it's a rare opportunity to see the show. And it sounds like it will be a somewhat slightly revised version of it.
Yeah.
And good Lord, Raul Esparza is a perfect casting choice.
Thank you.
Perfect casting choice.
I'm really excited. Yeah.
I mean, if anybody can do that part, it's him.
Yeah.
It's the John Lithgow part. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. I was excited when I saw the press release for that. So anyway, Ted, thank you so much for taking the time.
Much
chat about Floyd Collins, and much continued success, and hopefully we will talk again soon.
We'll talk again soon, Donald.
The air was cold and the ground was wet. I was just as muddy as a man could get. Hadn't any light but a little oil lantern. Got you in so tight that you know you can't turn back. I was slithering round on my belly and knees. I could feel my fingertips about to freeze. I could almost see where the prisoner lay, just about to holler when I heard him pray.
Oh my Lord, on my soul, don't let me die alone in this dark hole. And when my Savior is at hand, I'll be sure to meet him on top of the land.
Won't go digging round in the hollows and holes, I'ma leave it up to the hogs and moles. Won't ever set another foot inside a cave if I make it out of this lonesome grave. And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside. He swallowed what I had right out of my head.
Then he took some coffee from an old tin can, told him we would soon dig him out of this place, and a little smile goes across his face. He said, "Boy, thank God that you are here. Now I know my rescue is near. And when my time comes to die, I'll be sure to do it where I can see sky. Won't go digging round in the hollows and holes. I'ma leave it up to the hogs and moles. Never set another foot inside a cave if I make it out of this lonesome grave." And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside.
And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside.